Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
We're starting our study of 2 Samuel tonight. It's obvious from the opening verses that there should not be a division between 1 and 2 Samuel. For the same occurrences that happened in chapter 30 and 31 of 1 Samuel are being briefly reviewed but continuing and added to. So it's obvious that originally these books were probably one. Now it came about after the death of Saul, when David had returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, that David remained 2 days in Ziklag. This, of course, tells us about that he has recaptured his family and possessions. He's wiped out the Amalekites. We made a big deal last lesson about how David was fulfilling the role of the king of Israel in fighting God's enemies while Saul was being destroyed. Now, notice again, and it happened on the third day, and behold, a man came out of the camp of Saul. A little bit later in verse 3, it's called the camp of Israel. It's obviously someone from the skirmish with the Philistines up in the valley of Jezreel. His clothes were torn. There was dust on his head. These are common signs of mourning. David will exhibit some of those down in verse 11 when he hears about what this man says. And it came about when he came to David that he fell to the ground and prostrated himself. This is, of course, a sign of respect for David as the a leader, oriental potentate kind of personage. And David said to him, "From where do you come?" And he said, "I have escaped from the camp of Israel." Now, we're not sure if this man was somehow a slave of one of the Israeli soldiers, if he was a camp cook, something like that, or if he is a deserter some way, or if he is one of these camp followers that simply went around after the battles and stripped the dead of all valuables. Probably a camp looter from the rest of the story. So David asked him about how did things go. "Please tell me." And he said, "The people have fled from the battle, and also many of the people have fallen and are dead, and Saul and Jonathan his son are dead also." So David said to the young man and told him, "How do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead?" And the young man said, "By chance I happened to be on Mount Gilboa, and behold, Saul was leaning on his spear." Now, I don't know how you just happened to be on Mount Gilboa. Would you just happen to be in the midst of a battle? I think he was there looting the dead. Notice it says, and Saul was leaning on his spear. Now, there are two accounts here of Saul's death, one in chapter 31 of 1 Samuel, and another account here in chapter 1 of 2 Samuel. It seems to me, though, that we don't need to somehow harmonize these two accounts, but that this Amalekite young man is trying to gain some favor and reward from David. And what we have is a concocted story. I think the accurate account of Saul's death is in chapter 31 of 1 Samuel. And this is somewhat a falsification made up by the man here. Now, it is true that he found Saul leaning on his spear or his sword. Saul killed himself by putting his sword in the ground and falling on it. And notice, it was true the chariots and horsemen pursued him closely. As you remember, he was hurt by an archer. And we know that archers were in the chariots. The very fact that Saul tried to fight the Philistines in a geographical area where their chariots could be used shows the desperateness of Saul's condition. So here he is wounded, fleeing from these charioteers. Somewhat surprising this man could find him before the chariots found him. Maybe it got night and the chariots couldn't pursue him. Maybe the terrain got rugged and they couldn't go up the hill. We're not sure, but there was a little time left between the pursuing Philistines and Saul's death. And he looked behind him and saw me and called me, and I said, "Here am I." Now, of course, that's an idiom, a Hebrew idiom of availability. We see the same thing in Isaiah chapter 6, verse 8, where Isaiah says, "Here am I, send me." So it's a kind of a common idiom. And he said to me, "Who are you?" And I answered, "I am an Amalekite." Now, Amalekites were the traditional enemies of Israel. I'm surprised that he would mention that. Amalekites from back in the Exodus period would attack the end of the train of the Jews coming out of Egypt, the old men, the sick ones, and they became a real byword of evil and horror, and that's why David had been fighting them earlier. It's mentioned here. And he said to me, "Please stand by me and kill me, for agony has seized me, and my life still lingers in me." It's a very rare Hebrew word in verse 9. Some try to translate it as cramps from losing blood. We're just not sure exactly what this Hebrew word means. "And I stood by him and killed him." Now, in chapter 31, verse 4, it says Saul killed himself. because I knew he could not live after he had fallen. And I took the crown which was on his head and the bracelet which was on his arm, and I have brought them here to my lord. Now, it's surprising he didn't bring the spear. For the spear seemed to be the symbol of Saul's kingship. This crown probably was not the royal crown that he wore at times of state meetings, but a smaller crown wore in time of battle. Now, this is the only occurrence I know of the bracelet here as a symbol of the kingship of Israel. When David heard this, he tore his clothes. He mourned and wept and fasted. These are all signs of mourning until evening in verse 12. Now, evening was the beginning of the new day. Remember from the Old Testament, Genesis 1, where it says the evening and the morning were the first day. The Jews begin their day at the sign of the first evening star. That later came to be codified at twilight or about 6 p.m. And David said to the young man who told him, "Where are you from?" And he answered, "I am a son of an alien, an Amalekite." That means he was a sojourner. He had some limited rights within Israel, and he may have been somehow loosely connected with the army. And David said to him, "How is it that you are not afraid to stretch out your hand and destroy the Lord's anointed?" Now, David had had a chance two times, we know of, to kill Saul, and did not because of his respect for Saul's office, Saul's calling. This young man didn't sense that sense of reverence and was willing to kill him. Now, you can rationalize it that he was going to die and he just helped Saul, but David has a sense of the holy about God's king. And David called one of the young men and said, "Go and cut him down." So he struck him and he died. Now here is David acting as judge. I think the man made this up, but he still dies at his own words. Verse 17. By the way, the word anointed and the word Messiah are the same word, and so it's a sense of calling and equipping by God. Then David chanted this lament over Saul and Jonathan his son, and he told them to teach the sons of Judah. Now my New American Standard has the song of the bow. There's been much controversy about this little phrase. As you can tell in your Bible, the word "the song of" is in italics, which means it's not in the Hebrew text. The word "bow" is here. Now some add the word, like King James, add the little phrase, "teach the sons of Judah the use of the bow," meaning we're going to sing this song kind of like a war cry so you can practice your archery more and be more prepared. Well, I think that's somewhat surprising since these men were archers and users of the sling, and they were very adept at that, and that seems out of place. Some say, well, it means the song of the bow, meaning the name of the lament. Some say it goes to verse 22 where Jonathan's bow is mentioned as one of his powerful weapons, and maybe that's true. Others have said, like the Septuagint simply omits the word, the bow, just leaves it out. Now, it's interesting that the New English Bible believes this little Hebrew word for bow, made up of three letters, is really an acrostic for the name of the lament. And that may be true, for we have several laments in the Bible that are named. It is written in the book of Jasher. Now, the book of Jasher is mentioned back in Joshua chapter 10, verse 13. It's mentioned several times in the Old Testament. It seems to be a collection of Israeli war poems. And that's about as much as we know about it. In Hebrew, it means to be straight, and that's used for the sense of righteousness. And so it's a book about the righteous wars of the Lord. Now, here is the lament. It's one of the most ancient laments we have, another example of David's writing ability. "Your beauty, O Israel, is slain on your heights." Now, because down here a little lower, about, let's see, I think it's verse 22, I've lost where it is. Down a little bit later in the psalm, it seems to be a way of referring to Jonathan and Saul. The word here, beauty, is really the word glory. It's even possible in Hebrew to revocalize it as gazelle, which would mean an animal of beauty and grace and that kind of thing. And in verse 20, we come across two of the cities of the Philistines, Gath and Ashkelon. Gath was the farthest away from where David was. Ashkelon was the closest. They're obviously used as a way of referring to the entire Philistine nation. And, of course, this nation of five major Philistine cities is kind of based on the Greek way of doing a government, which is a city-state. And, of course, the Philistines, we think, are mercenaries from the Aegean Sea, so that seems to fit their political structure. Notice in verse 21 where David puts a curse on Mount Gilboa. Now, this is more literary than actual because the ground shouldn't be cursed just because that's where Saul and Jonathan died. But notice it mentions here the field of offerings, which the Jerusalem Bible translates as the treacherous fields. And that may be true. The shield of Saul is mentioned, and it says it's not anointed with oil. These ancient shields were covered with leather. So if it was a fiery dart, it would sink into the leather and put it out. And so you'd put oil on that leather to keep it soft and pliable so that the arrow would stick in it. You might want to see Isaiah chapter 21, verse 5, for another example of these leather shields being oiled. In verse 23, I think it's interesting that it mentions that Saul and Jonathan were together in their death. Now, of course, in their life, they had great personality clashes, particularly over David. But here, they die together, which David saw as a sign of blessing. Now, in verse 24, it mentions, O daughters of Israel, weep over Saul. Now, we know from other passages that the young women ran out to meet the returning troops, primarily the virgins or the unmarried women. We see this particularly in 1 Samuel 18:7, also in 21:11 and 29:5 of 1 Samuel, and you might want to look at that. There's even a mention of this where Miriam did this as she greeted the troops back in the Pentateuch. Also notice, if you would, in verse 27 where it mentions here, verse 26 is interesting, your love to me was more wonderful than the love of women. Many have asserted that this is by the aspect of homosexuality, but I think that's reading much too much into this. Jonathan was always extremely caring about David. From the very time they met, there was a bond there. Jonathan, the crown prince of Israel, knew that David was the one to succeed his father. He even gave him his armament, recognized him early, tried to protect him from his father. There was a great friendship. I do not think it has anything to do with homosexuality, which is so condemned in the book of Leviticus. Notice it says in verse 27, the weapons of war perished. I think that's referring, in a metaphorical sense, to Saul and Jonathan. Now, if you want a summary of this same battle, you ought to see 1 Chronicles chapter 11, verses 1 through 3, correlates the same events. Now for chapter 2. Then it came about afterwards that David inquired of the Lord, saying... Now, this acquiring of the Lord basically goes back to the use, I think, of the Urim and the Thummim. Now, this, of course, was Abiathar, the sole remaining ancestor of the priesthood at Nob, or Eli's dynasty. Remember, after the slaughter by Saul at Nob, this one man was left, and he escaped to David. He was the recognized high priest. Apparently, he took the high priestly garments, and behind the breastplate of the 12 stones was a pocket where the Urim and the Thummim was kept, and it was a way of knowing God's will. Now, we're very uninformed about this as far as what exactly this looked like or how it was used, but it seems to me, for the context of chapter 2, that it was not simply a yes or no answer, because Hebron seems to be pointed out, so maybe there was a way of spelling things out or some other way of knowing. Now, David, if you can see, is going to move from the town of Ziklag in the border area to the Philistines to a more secure headquarters back in the tribal allocation of Judah, and that'll be Hebron. It was an ancient city, a walled city. We know of it from the book of Joshua because the Anakim lived there. It became Caleb's possession. And David went up there, his two wives also, and they're mentioned. David brought up his men who were with him, each with his household. So they just deserted Ziklag and brought all the families to Hebron. Now, it's obvious that they must have worked this out with the inhabitants of Hebron, where David and his men got certain buildings and certain lands. It says the villages of Hebron, which may mean the cities around Hebron, is some of them is what David took as his place to live. And the men of Judah came, and there anointed David king over the house of Judah. It's interesting to me that in verse 4, this is the second of three anointings by David. The first one occurred back in 1 Samuel chapter 16, verse 13, as Samuel anointed him privately before his family to be king of the people of God. Here in this passage, he is anointed as king over Judah, and later on in 2 Samuel, particularly 2 Samuel chapter 5, verse 3, he's anointed by the elders as king over all Israel. This anointing, of course, was a special act. There are three groups in the Old Testament that are anointed: prophets, priests, and kings. It was a special sign of God's calling and equipping. They mentioned to the men about Jabesh Gilead. Now, this goes down through verse 7. This was a city in the Transjordan area on the eastern bank that Saul defended early in his kingship from enemies. And this city always was so grateful for Saul coming to their aid that when Saul was, of course, killed and his beheaded and was hanged from the city gate, the men of this city made a daring raid on this Philistine town and got Saul's body and buried him. David was grateful for how they acted toward his friend. And so he writes them a letter of thanksgiving. There probably is an ulterior motive here, or at least a secondary motive, of hoping this city would affirm David as the new king. But notice verse 6 where it says, "And may the Lord," that's the word Yahweh, all caps, "show loving kindness and truth to you." Now, I hope you'll look at different English translations here. The word loving kindness is the Hebrew word hesed. It's this special word connected to the covenant. It means God's no strings attached covenant loyalty. The second word is emeth. It's kind of a form of the word truthfulness or faithfulness, trustworthiness. Now, these are the qualities that God exhibits toward men. This city attributed those same qualities toward Saul. And here David is praying that God will show this city these same kind of qualities. He also hopes that they're going to follow him, and you see in verse 7, as king, but they do not do that at this point. Now in verse 8, "But Abner, the son of Ner, commander of Saul's army, had taken Ishbosheth." Now Ishbosheth, we learn from the parallel in 1 Chronicles chapter 8, verse 33, that his name was originally Ishbaal. Now, Ish is the Hebrew word for man, and Baal is, of course, the Canaanite fertility god, the male fertility god, that primarily entered Israel through Phoenicia. But the Jews changed all the names. Ishbaal, they would change to Ishbosheth. Bosheth is the Hebrew word for shame. So from the title, a man of Baal, was turned into a man of shame. And that's going to happen to Mephibosheth and several other people that originally had the word Baal in their name, son of Saul, and brought him over. And this city here is somewhere in the area of Gilead, the Transjordan area to the north. And it became the capital for the nation of Israel. Notice it's removed from the Philistine area. The Philistines had now captured the valley of Jezreel, and this is over in the Transjordan area. Exactly how much territory Ishbosheth really reigned over is in somewhat a dispute. Now, verse 9 has been a great controversy. "And he made him king over Gilead, and over the Asherites, and over Jezreel, and over Ephraim, and over Benjamin, even all of Israel." Now, this may have been ideal and not in reality. This word Asherites has caused great confusion. Some say that refers to the tribe of Asher. Others say the Targum, it refers to the city of Asher in Mesopotamia. Others, the Hebrew Masoretic text says it's the Assyrians. The Peshitta, which is the Syriac translation about the 5th century A.D., and the Vulgate say it is the Gershurites, which is a city in this area. But the truth is, we're not sure what that means. Now, verses 10 and 11 are interesting because it says that Ishbosheth ruled for 2 years, and then in verse 11 it says, "But David ruled for 7.5 years at Hebron." There's been several different ways to look at this. Number one, that Abner did not make Ishbosheth king immediately, but tried to subdue some of the Philistine influence that had crept so far north. And maybe it wasn't until a few years later that Ishbosheth was really anointed as king. Others say that possibly David ruled over the united Israel for 5 years at Hebron before he moved to Jerusalem, made Jerusalem his capital. Others say that David was not made king immediately, and that's why this discrepancy. There's an obvious problem here between 2.5 years and 7.5 years. And it's in all our manuscripts, so we don't want to just attribute it to a scribal error. But the truth is, we're not sure how it relates. Now, there was a meeting, apparently, at Gibeon. Now, Gibeon is on the tribal allocation, the northern fringe of the tribal allocation of Benjamin. It would be closer, somewhat closer to Hebron than it was to the Transjordan area, but it's kind of a place in the middle. The two armies met there, Joab and his men and Abner and his men. And apparently, I guess they were just going to talk, or Abner came to try to stop the northern advance of David's reign and kingdom. I'm not sure. But notice in verse 14, "Now let the young men arise and hold a contest before us." Notice Abner is the one that says that. In Hebrew, it's the word play, but from the gruesome details of what follows, we know that it was a hand-to-hand combat between 12 members of David's army and 12 members of Ish-bosheth's army. Now, this may be a representative battle, somewhat like Goliath, where the winner is supposedly the winner of the whole thing, but we're not sure. The 12 men came together. They got too excited. They forgot their defensive moves, and each of them stabbed the other one. And so all 24 died, apparently. When that happened, the two armies clashed together. Now, verse 16, the place where this happened is in Hebrew called the field of the sword edges, or flint knives. Now, we're not sure what that means. Some say it means it's a field where they got many flints for their arrows and spears. Others say, no, the field was shaped like a long spear or flint. Others say, no, it's a metaphor for the hardness or strongness of the men that fought there. Now, we're just not sure. It's going to become obvious, and we look at the numbers, that far more of Abner's men died than Joab's men. Another sign that David is being blessed by God. Well, at this point, in verse 18, we're introduced to the three sons of Zeruiah. Now, one of them is Joab, David's military commander, and two other ones are Abishai and Asahel. Asahel's the youngest. He gets on Abner's trail. He was very fast, kind of known as a gazelle almost, and he just wouldn't get off Abner's trail. Abner kept saying, now, son, go fight someone else. Get off my trail. Go fight another person and take their spoil. Now, we think that spoil referred to in verse 21 may be the belt they wore, their weapons of war, some kind of prize that they had taken off people, somewhat like the Indians took scalps, but we don't know what it is. But Asahel would not. And so Abner was an old military man. I mean, he had many tricky moves. He just kind of stopped suddenly, and his spear went into the belly of Asahel and, of course, killed him. He tried to talk the young man out of pursuing him because he didn't want any bad blood between him and Joab. But the young man would not, and the young man died. In verse 23, we see this young man must have been very popular, for all of David's army stopped where he died and had a moment of silence there. And I think you can see that. But then they continued to pursue Abner. And finally, after a period of time, Abner calls out in verse 27, after the Benjamites had kind of gathered around him, Joab said, "As God lives, if you had not spoken, surely then the people would have gone away in the morning, each from following his brother." Now, this seems to be a play, "As God lives," a play on the word Yahweh. Matter of fact, the Septuagint even has the word "as the Lord lives" here, which is a Greek translation of the Hebrew Yahweh. For we think the word means to be, from Exodus 3:14. So, "as God lives" is a way of saying what this name implies, the ever-living, only living God. The thing seems to be here, Joab responds to Abner's call about, "Why don't you quit following us, quit following your brothers, we're killing one another, it's going to cause bad blood for years between us." And Joab says, "You know, Abner, if you hadn't started this by asking for us to have this hand-to-hand combat the day before, it wouldn't have happened." And he also says, "Your words started this problem, and your words will stop this problem, so let's go home." And it's cut off right there. Verse 30 and 32, "They began to bury their dead. There was 19 of David's servants missing, but there were 360 of Ish-bosheth's servants missing." And you can see how it's obvious the blessing of God was still on David. Ish-bosheth was a very weak king, and Abner took advantage of that to be the power behind the throne, pretty much did what he wanted to. He was a very strong military leader. And we can see here, though, that he just can't fight against God's army, apparently, who has... the men were pretty evenly matched. That's what the death of the 12 and the 12 shows. They both had military prowess. Both were strong and young. But God was with one group and not with the other group. And that's why we have the disparity here of the numbers killed. Well, that's about where we're going to stop in our introduction to 2 Samuel. I hope you'll see it as a continuation of 1 Samuel, and we're beginning to see David's reign solidifying among the tribes. Well, I've really enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.